Hello and welcome to Rapids Fire, the Accelerated Data Science Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Mahler. This week, I'm going to be talking about data visualization with Alan Enemark, who leads the data visualization part of the Rapids team, and Brian Van de Ven, who, among other things, was one of the co-creators of the Bokeh visualization library for Python. This seems like a natural thing for GPUs to get involved in. The G in GPU, after all, is graphics. And I talk with these gentlemen about their overall strategy of integrating acceleration into existing visualization tools, Pythonic workflows in data visualization, JavaScript and its possible future in contributing to better, clearer, faster visualizations, and much more. I hope you enjoy the episode, and I'll be back after the break. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Paul.
Hey, Paul. Thanks to have us.
Alan, you originally started your career as a designer. It looks like one of your first gigs was doing stuff in physical space. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up where you are.
A meat space, that wonderful world. Well, funny enough, when I just got out of like high school and they had the whole decide what you want to do with your life thing, I initially considered doing computer science. But then I thought, I don't want to be behind a computer all day. So I'm going to skip that. Ends up being full circle. But then I just eventually discovered industrial design, which is still a really cool thing. And I happened to get in around the same time like Apple started getting extra designy with their things. So it was a fun time to be an industrial designer making physical products. Pretty quickly, because I could quote code, and this meant Flash back in the day, I started doing UIs and mocking up prototypes and stuff there. And that sort of inevitably let me down going into more data visualizations and things like that. So as you know, I ended up in Accenture Tech Labs where I met you and started doing data viz stuff there until I am now at NVIDIA, which has been a lot of fun. And getting to advance the state of data viz using GPUs.
Brian, tell us about yourself. It looks like for people that don't know, and I know that you'll get to this, you were the original developer of Bokeh. I guess my first question is how to say that. I've only ever seen it written. I know that it means lens flare. I guess I'm curious if you were really into photography at the time that you began developing this. Don't let me steal your thunder or front run your biography. Please tell us about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've been doing sort of programming a long time, ever since I was a kid. And I actually started my academic career in computer science. And I worked there for a little while, but I've always been interested in science. And so I actually went back to school for sort of physics and ended up in grad school for physics. But after leaving grad school, I actually went to work back in software, but I wanted to work in sort of scientific adjacent software development. So I worked for a research lab at the University of Texas that worked on sonar systems. And I worked for a scientific Python consulting firm in sort of the early aughts. And then around 2012, Peter Wang and Travis Oliphant, the creator of NumPy, started a company called Continuum Analytics at the time, which later became Anaconda. And so that was another chance to sort of work in, you know, this sort of scientific or data science or, you know, analytical software development. And after quite a number of years there, I moved around a little bit and then ended up at NVIDIA, which has been really great because NVIDIA is very close to the sort of PyData ecosystem of tools that I really enjoyed working on and around at Anaconda.
So with Bokeh, at the time I remember I first heard about it, I was at Accenture Tech Labs with Alan. And that was a very creative time for different data visualization across the board. But I also remember that there were just a lot of things coming out at once. I know that D3 was the thing that really sparked a lot of people's interest in data visualization and the things that could be done with it.
A shout out to Hotshot Charts. That's the OG data viz that all of our kind of teams started off with. So if you didn't catch Hotshot Charts, you missed out, guys.
Yeah, I believe it was finally taken down a couple of years ago. For people that don't know, founder of Rapids, Josh Patterson, when he was at Tech Labs, had done a mock-up, I believe, in R that fit with basketball analytics. So it was very shareable at the time. And it was great for Accenture and great for Tech Labs because it showed where on the court a given player was most likely to be able to make a shot. You know, around the time that, you know, D3 came out, then there was Shiny in the R ecosystem. I remember Seaborn, and then I remember seeing Boca. I hope I'm saying that right. Is that the right way to say it?
You know, there's a pretty broad range of, I think, acceptable pronunciations. People say Boca. I think I usually say bokeh. They're all good. Just actually going back to your original question, you know, that name was created by Peter Wang, who's one of the co-founders of Anaconda. And Peter and I would say are the co-creators of Bokeh, but honestly, there are a lot of people involved in the very beginning. Hugo Shi and Patty Mullen were original contributors to Bokeh as well. But, you know, there's sort of a technical meaning related to photography for Bokeh, which is around the sort of the lens flare and these hexagonal patterns you can get. But there's a more general Japanese term, Bokeh, that means sort of choosing which parts to bring into focus and out of focus. And I think that's what Peter had in mind with Bokeh. You know, sort of originally, we wanted to sort of tie in some of the ideas that are in projects like DataShader now, where you can really look at large data sets and really be able to sort of focus in on specific aspects of it very quickly. And those don't live in Bokeh proper right now, but they're in sort of other libraries. But that's the original sort of conception of that term. You know, the reason we created Bokeh was, you know, going back a little bit further, Peter Wang created a library called Chaco for data visualization in the aughts, maybe 2006 or so. And it was very geared towards interactive data visualization, but it was also for rich clients. So like an actual Qt or GTK application that you would make. And it was a great library, but it was a little bit fiddly to use. It was kind of contemporaneous to Matplotlib. And in the end, we all know Matplotlib really won that horse race. Come 2012, Anaconda was starting. We wanted to create a new version of that sort of interactive data visualization tool, but target it for the browser. That was clear. That was the right place to be. And so we wanted to take the lessons we learned from Chaco, try to make it a little bit easier for users to approach, less sort of fiddly, and also put this interactive data visualization capability in the browser.
For both of you, how would you say that your experiences working with other tools have influenced the way you think about designing new tools?
Well, I like that question. And designing tools is kind of the key words there. So as part of the Viz team in Rapids, a lot of what we're doing is not necessarily trying to make the next big fancy Viz library, but really trying to integrate with the Viz libraries that are out there. Because as you mentioned, there's a lot of them. They're all pretty great. They have a lot of history behind them. So we're just trying to make them better. And a lot of that really comes down to, especially these days, enhancing the interactivity and the scale of the data you can work with, as well as like ease of use and things like that. But that's sort of the thing that really appeals to me is in using GPUs is now you can start to interact with these very large data sets and you don't necessarily have to worry as much about it. Oh, you know, will this Viz be performant or will I be able to handle showing all these data points at the same time? So really trying to integrate with tools so they can start doing that or help the community develop tools that can leverage sort of the throughput of data that we have now.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of sort of my experience, you know, my main experience now after almost almost 9 years working in sort of open source and around Bokeh in particular is, you know, I almost want to say it's documentation driven design. In the sense that I think about how easy would it be to document this thing that we're trying to build or this little new feature, this new aspect. And if it doesn't seem easy to document, there's probably something wrong with it in terms of what users will see. Because if it's confusing us, you know, at the point that we're trying to think about how would we explain this, then it's certainly going to confuse users when it goes out there in the wild. And so that's always a first concern of mine is to sort of think about what is the user experience going to be like for this new feature or this new part of the tool that we're building.
Alan, when you say that you want to make things more interactive, that's a word that can have a lot of different meanings in different settings. Do you mean that it is more interactive just by virtue of the load they can handle? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, this sort of pairs well with what Brian just said of the documents is sort of making the user experience for a developer better if it's well documented. What I have in my mind, meaning interactive, is sort of making the, you know, experience for like the data scientist or the Viz analyst better, because when you have to do a thing where if you have, and this is normally for larger data sets, but like if I want to explore that very large data set, usually I, you know, traditional tools means you kind of have to click or make a query and then sort of wait. And this could be anything from minutes to, you know, 10 seconds before you kind of get the result of that click or action or query, which is, you know, okay for some settings, but interactive wise, that sort of starts inhibiting how you behave with that data. and like how you would behave with that tool, because it's like working with a really slow computer. You know, after a while you kind of get tired of it, and it's less of exploring properly. Like, I'm going to click on here and do all these kind of crazy type queries just to see what happens, versus I'm going to kind of pre-validate. Yeah, I think this will get me the right result that I'm wanting. And then you click on it and that's what you kind of go with. So that's sort of what I mean by interactive in that sense. DataShader is a very good example of that. We recently worked with them so that we could implement CUDA-EF and use that GPUs and DataShader, which is all a really fast and powerful tool for doing geospatial and graph and whatever. It's if you are not aware of it, it's one of my favorite PyViz tools out there currently. But basically, I found myself using it to kind of really explore around and click around and just zoom in and zoom out and do things which was just sort of for fun to see what it looked like, versus worrying about, well, I should do this query or I should click on this area because it probably is interesting. And then you end up finding some really cool insights that way too. So it's really fostering interacting with your data easier, faster, that kind of thing.
With KuCross Filter, can you tell the audience a little bit more about what that is? And for those that may try to Google KuCross Filter, it's actually written KuX Filter.
Yeah, so KuCross Filter is sort of one of the first Viz projects we did in Rapids. And in the really, really early days, it was basically a demo, but one of the super powerful things of using CUDA-EF ended up being cross-filtering, which is essentially just selecting one subset of a data and being able to filter that for a lot of the different other subsets. And so it makes great for interactive dashboarding that way, cross-filter dashboards. Originally, as we were building it out, we realized, again, we didn't want to sort of make our own Viz library. We sort of wanted to take the best of what's out there and make it easier to use. And so a lot of what KuCross Filter does is it takes, you know, the great DeckGL charts that are out there for GeoViz and utilizes DataShader or it uses Bokeh charts in a much more compact API, so that you can then just quickly laid out in a nice dashboard, which I like to plug. We just got to use interactive layouts now. So in the next release, keep an eye out for that. That was with a great partnership with Panel and the general PyViz community. So yeah, it's basically a really great way to quickly build cross-filter dashboard apps to kind of prototype and explore your data and zoom in and out of it really easily without worrying about making all the, you know, events, connections, and things like that, where you just want to quickly take a look at your data.
It sounds like you have primarily sought to integrate with other existing tools. I think that other parts of Rapids had a similar spirit, but were freestanding software that followed existing APIs. What other integrations have you done or will you do in the near future?
I mean, Brian can speak to it as well, but I feel like through building tools like KuCross Filter, we've sort of been able to interact with the wider PyViz community, HoloViz especially, just because we started with DataShader and that was a lot of fun actually. And then that sort of led us to, for instance, working very closely with John Meese, who's a great contributor, now working for Plotly. And so then that sort of led us to then collaborate with Plotly and develop Rapids integrations into their frameworks, which then sort of also led into integrating with HoloViews, which is another great Python Viz framework. You know, we just started talking about with them about, hey, can we have dynamic layouts and things like that? We found an interesting framework that we implemented in QX Filter, and they said, hey, that's great. We're going to integrate it in HoloViews. So there's a lot of cross-pollination happening now, which makes me really excited because it's a pretty close-knit community. When you come down to it, it's just a couple of, you know, developers talking amongst each other. And to be able to take Rapids and kind of have them get excited about Rapids and what GPUs can offer and be able to contribute back to that general community, it's been a lot of fun. And it's, I think, maybe a big reason why Brian joined us in the first place and why Rapids is, I think, pretty genuine when it means we're trying to be an open source software type framework.
Yeah, no, I just would echo all of that. Being able to interact again with the PyData community sort of very closely in a lot of different ways is for sure one of the reasons why I was very strongly drawn to come to NVIDIA. And I'd also just like to echo that, yeah, QX Filter is this great sort of melting pot where a lot of technologies come together, both from the NVIDIA side where, you know, we use QDF and we use all the GPU tools, but then there's also, yeah, a variety of different Viz tools from the PyData space that come together. And there is a lot of great cross-pollination. For instance, you know, the layout stuff has been evolving over the last year. And so there was some ways that could be improved in Bokeh, like some of Bokeh's layout options that, you know, are used by Panel on top of Bokeh could use some improvement. And so we got that really concrete feedback from, you know, an actual use case, and we're able to drive improvements in Panel and drive improvements in Bokeh and then feed those back to QCrossFilter. And so that's always a rewarding sort of experience, and very happy to see that. I guess I'd mention some other ways, you know, we sort of collaborate with the broader community is not even necessarily through code. Alan, I was going to mention, you know, we did do some tutorials for JupyterCon last year.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a way we sort of, that was actually, I thought, really great, because although the tutorial was on, you know, sort of Rapids Viz, we got to make use of a lot of different libraries. And so this was a chance to show those libraries off. And so we sort of interacted with the Jupyter part of the PyData community there. And I thought that was a really great opportunity to sort of show off the tools, you know, that we have here at NVIDIA.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. It's a great tutorial, by the way, if you get a chance, check it out. Yeah, it was a great tutorial because it kind of showcases, again, another thing about Viz. It's never just for the sake of visualizing a chart, but the fact that as being part of Rapids, it kind of plays well with all these other libraries pretty seamlessly. So you could, you know, go from QDF to then converting it to QGraph, and then you can go visualize it in QXFilter, and then you can then build a, you know, proper dashboard application through Plotly Dash. And it all chains nicely together in Python at Bow, and which has been another part of, which is this community that we're sort of trying to keep lively, is just the fact that, yeah, there's tons of libraries out there, but oftentimes they kind of get abandoned, or, you know, people just move on or lose interest, which is a real shame because some of these are some really powerful libraries. So I feel like with this cross-pollination, it kind of keeps the energy and momentum going, keeps these libraries kind of having that critical mass of developer interest, which makes them turn into really great stuff. Because again, Bokeh has like been around for a while, and I can get a sense that they have like ebbs and flows of developer interest. But, you know, the last thing you want is for these great libraries kind of be abandoned because they don't have any development behind it.
When you were originally working on data visualization, did you have a lot of quizzical responses when you told people what you did? Were your friends surprised that you were working for Accenture?
I mean, yeah, it's funny. It's sort of like when I first started doing industrial design, it's very much the same thing. It's like people think like, oh, you make bridges and stuff. And I'm like, you know, no, like every product ever. But then, like I mentioned, then Apple came about, and like industrial design became this kind of like rock star sort of profession. So DataViz, I wouldn't call it a rockstar profession yet, but I still get a lot of quizzical looks from people, but I definitely feel that the community has gotten much, much bigger over the years. Like I know in Slack, there's the DataViz Society, which was started by a couple of folks from like Netflix and others. And it's like a huge community now. It's definitely evolved over time. I'm really curious to see where it goes from here. So some of the things that we're looking into more in the future is, again, pushing the boundaries of the field on like a tool-wise perspective. And one of the things is, yeah, we've been talking a lot about the kind of Python ecosystem and all that, but the web basically runs on JavaScript. So we're closely trying to figure out how we can more closely integrate in the JavaScript world with the Viz community and things like that, and WebGL and things like that. It just seems like a native fit. That's sort of the things we're working on in the next phase, because as the tools get more developed and mature, we can kind of start seeing, as I like to think about it, blending from high-performance computer world, which is usually like very isolated in the sense of by default, they're working on some clusters and the data is so large that they can't really share it easily, with the capability of GPUs now and web browsers and server-side stuff, so that I feel like those worlds are sort of blurring in interesting ways, and we want to kind of take advantage of that. So we feel like that's essentially through JavaScript, because that is the web.
What I'm curious about, JavaScript is the web, but my question is, how would the work or the research that you're doing on JavaScript fit with what you've been doing so far?
Well, that's sort of the big question, right? The biggest issue is figuring out the architecture for this stuff. And so that's sort of what we've been really scratching our heads with. If you're accessing a remote server or the one that you have under your desk, you know, everybody has a browser. And so that seems like the common medium to kind of target. At the same time, also that sort of weak point of HPC is like, if it's able to go through your browser and you can share it through the web and things like that, that's sort of a big reason why D3 and Viz took off, you know, that's 10 years ago, was because it was so easy to share and access to this wider audience, right? Like, I feel like there's so many really powerful performing visualization library, like high performing visualization libraries, but they're like in C in some GitHub repo somewhere. And then that's like, all right, you get your 10 stars and that's it, because it's just so hard to kind of share and use with a community. So that's where, again, the web scale tech really shines, and another reason why we're focusing on it.
Yeah. And I guess I would also chime in, because I think it's an interesting way to think about it for me, is that, you know, although there is a lot of JavaScript in the browser, you know, there's a very rich ecosystem of people running applications in Node, and there's a big JavaScript community there. And so, you know, I think there's questions about what, you know, what ways can these tools be brought to that audience as well. And, you know, so that's exciting questions, you know, and in terms of like what that could be useful for HPC, I think it's sort of the same question as with Python. You know, Python was good for HPC because it was a very good glue language that let you sort of bring a lot of different resources to bear. And I think, you know, JavaScript could have a similar role, both in the browser, but also in, you know, Node applications on the back end as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Glue is a good way to describe it.
What do y'all see as being big things, either in your own work or more generally in the community over the next 2 or 3 years?
That's a good question. In the Viz community as a whole, well, a lot of it is just continuing to kind of push the boundaries of literacy in a sense. As Paul, you know, one of my earlier things working into Data Viz was making like a Data Viz literacy curriculum so that you know, people can understand how to critique and build and make, you know, best case visualizations. And you just see a general misunderstanding of statistics and how to interpret them. So I feel like that's still a long road to hoe in that one, to just get people to understand these things better.
In terms of Bokeh, it's interesting. Coming up close to 10 years now that Bokeh has been around, you know, I think we're really in a bit of a reflective period and trying to figure out, well, what is really important and what, you know, what areas have we spent time or effort on that maybe we don't need to, you know, continue, or, you know, where can we streamline things and make things simpler. But also for me personally, you know, I think it's really incumbent on me to help attract, you know, more developers, and especially more core developers. We just added someone to the core team, or about to announce that. And so I think that's always really important to try to broaden people working on it, to get those additional perspectives and sort of make it easier for users to use, because the user experience has the input from more developers. So that's sort of where, you know, my next couple of years, I think, of involvement in Bokeh is really just trying to foster the community and especially the community of developers to an even higher level.
Now, I know that Bokeh is built into Dask, which I've mentioned on previous podcasts and has been very important to Rapids. This might be a silly question, but is Bokeh GPU accelerated at this point? Do you have plans for that?
That's a really good question. You know, I don't know that there's a lot of really effective touch points here. We do have some WebGL backends. So yeah, so there's some WebGL backends, and we're actually in the process of trying to sort of do a second version of our WebGL implementation. And actually a new contributor with a lot of experience has come on and seems interested in helping us to do that. So that is one possibility for WebGL accelerated drawing, right? And so that's really good, and it'll be nice. We'll continue to improve that. In terms of computation, you know, there's different ways to use Bokeh. You can use Bokeh server Python process with the front end, and that could certainly use any of the Rapids tools. So you could imagine a Bokeh server application that calls out the QDF or QGraph or QML or any of those tools. And then you can just use Bokeh for standalone content in the browser, where it's just a JavaScript application basically. And, you know, there the question is, well, how do you access the GPU? And so if there were ways to sort of use some GPU acceleration for compute in, for instance, JavaScript callbacks, that could be interesting, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. And I think there's still some things to figure out for that kind of usage.
Yeah, it's actually back to that kind of architecture question. When you say GPU accelerated, there's a lot of actually different ways you can go about doing that. It is an interesting problem to kind of figure out. And I feel like whatever the solution we come up with, it has to be seamless in the sense of, you know, one of the worst problems I have is you start out exploring a data set and it's kind of a small little subset. And then you basically have to build out all this tooling to kind of play around with it. And as soon as you want to start playing with like the larger subset or a more complex problem, you know, the viz side chokes, and then you have to kind of start from scratch, right? So if you could build something where it could seamlessly switch into a, oh, well, this is going to be more than your system can handle, or more than this sort of viz chart can handle, we'll switch over to something that's able to handle the larger scale, that would be amazing, right? That would really take a lot of the burden. Because the last thing you want to do when you're doing like data viz and data science is like worrying about what tool I should use for my exploration, right? Because you're not answering the question of like, what is the best tools for my data sciencing, right? You're asking the questions from the data. So as much of that overhead that we can remove by just having smart tooling or more capable viz tooling and things like that, the better. Because then that leads back to the whole earlier point about just truly interacting with the data and being able to play around with it and ask questions of it versus all that like mental overhead of, you know, figuring out how I can even get access to it.
You had mentioned data literacy a little bit earlier. There was a great book that was actually written in the 60s called How to Lie with Statistics that I really think should be taught in every high school, and you don't need a mathematical background to read it. In that spirit, and I'm interested in what both of you might have to say about this, what are some good ways to lie with visualization?
I mean, this is classic like data viz 101 stuff, but you know, always look at the axes, right? If it doesn't have it, then don't believe the chart. And any good chart always has a little asterisk saying like, this is where we got our data from, or these are the conditions of our data. So like without those two things, then it's very easy to lie with charts. Classic book, by the way. I mean, still super relevant. Yeah, that's the quick version of it. It's easy to get pretty far with just a really bad made bar chart.
Yeah, no, it doesn't take much. I mean, very common things are having, you know, axes that start on values that, you know, aren't clear what values the axes actually start on, or having multiple axes that are on wildly different scales without really drawing attention to the fact that they're on different scales, or even having X and Y axes on different scales, but then putting a bubble chart on top of that, in which case, what does the size of the bubble represent if the scales aren't the same? And so there's all kinds of, you know, very specific ways to lie with charts. And, you know, some of that, you know, hopefully we can help people point to better ways, to effective ways to really visualize in an efficacious way.
For people that don't have a lot of exposure to data visualization, and especially talk about data visualization on Twitter, I'd like to hear from both of you about why data viz people hate pie charts so much.
You know, yeah, well, it's, hate's a strong word. It's kind of like with
intensely dislike.
Yeah. It's kind of like with designers and papyrus font, you know, it's sort of the same thing. In some rare cases, it actually serves a purpose, but for the majority of cases, actually makes the data worse. Like you could just use a bar chart to make it much, much clearer and more understandable. Usually the worst offender is the 3D pie chart, which is unexcusable.
Yeah. I mean, I think the main criticism is just the fact that, of course, if you have two quantities and you want to compare their magnitude, then you can just use a line or you know, a bar and very clearly see the relationship between those two quantities. Things scale differently when you involve area instead of distance, single 1D distance. There is a range of opinions, but definitely the tilt of, I think, the general opinion is, towards not using them, or at least being wary of them in general.
Circles are, and maybe this is just the way my brain is made up, much more difficult for me to visually reason about. So I guess to both of you, why do you think that bubble charts had such a big moment? I know that Gapminder, something that was originally developed in, I believe, Sweden, that had shown things like economic inequality over time, was really big when I worked at the World Bank, and I appreciated that, but it seems like bubble charts have become much more prolific and perhaps in some cases much less useful. What are your views on that?
Yeah, the Gapminder thing was Hans Rosling, late Hans Rosling, and you know, he gave that great TED talk where he showed off the Gapminder data, and he did this animated, you know, sort of evolution of some world statistics over time. And that was very popular and it's very good. And I think, that helped sort of raise the, you know, maybe the perception of those charts. And maybe since then there have been more. I have a pretty strong opinion. I think, you know, that bubble charts are not really good to do it all, unless the scales are absolutely, you know, on the same scale. So, you know, geographic, if you're working in, you know, UTM geographic, where you've got meters in both the X and Y direction, then you can have a bubble chart and that represents something. But if you have, you know, axes that are sort of wildly different scales, then I just think a bubble chart is sort of nonsense. But you do see that.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of comes down to the sort of story you're trying to tell. Again, Hans Rosling, excellent storyteller. So he can kind of get away with it a lot more in that sense. Plus, that chart was just fantastic because it has so many different attributes it's able to show at once. A lot has to do with what tools make it easily available to do bad charts. So kind of the biggest offender is generally like Excel, right? The defaults that they have are pretty awful. One of my favorite sayings is default isn't design. And so, you know, if there's just like you have your list of 20 charts and one of them is bubble and you're like, cool. And you don't actually know any principles behind, you know, being able to do comparison analysis around these charts, like then you just select bubble and it looks great because it's different looking or novel. So it looks good in your PowerPoint. And then sort of that sort of becomes a self-fulfilling thing where lots of people start seeing it being used and then they expect that, oh, well, that's just the default that's being used. So I'll use it too. Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to be careful in some of these things. You don't want to be snooty about it either. Again, it comes down to what is the story you're trying to tell. Like if your story has to have these very precise values and it's very technical, then yeah, you probably shouldn't be using bubble charts. But if your thing is like, you know, look at this bubble, it's 500 times larger than this other one. You don't actually care if it's like, it's just way bigger, right? That's the story. Then, you know, that's probably okay. The whole point is being able to communicate things to your audience, right? At the end of the day, that's the point of data viz and data science.
What's interesting in what you just told me is that it also seems to give me more of a view of the way that you think of data visualization in a nutshell and what's informed the development of the tools that you've worked on. When you talked about the interactivity, meaning nimbleness as you go about creating and refining your charts, to me, that relates to what you said about storytelling, because whenever you're creating something or writing something, it becomes more difficult as the creator to keep the thread of the story that you're trying to tell if each step in building it is extremely onerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And you lose a thread in your own mind too. So that's kind of the point behind that. And it's like, you know, it's never a linear way to get to that sort of conclusion, right? Like even when you tell the story afterwards, you make it just for the sake of having a good story and keeping the audience interested and keeping it succinct enough. But like generally, it's always a messy process of cleaning data that didn't work out, or this turned out to have not any interesting patterns whatsoever. And then you have to go back, and it's a very sort of exploratory iterative process. And like, if the tools you're using have a lot of friction in it because of bad, you know, developer documentation, or it's just slow, or it can't handle the data that you're using, then it's just gonna make you not do enough of those iterations to tell a good story at the end of the day. And oftentimes just sort of give up or miss stuff, right? That's at least because of my design background, like where I come from approaching the tools that we're building as much as possible. You know, just try to make people's lives easier in some sense or another. Stuff's hard enough as is. And last thing I want is technology to get in the way, because it already has a bad habit of doing that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it's interesting though. You know, one of the reasons I think there's a lot of tools now in the Python space, you know, for data visualization compared to say R, where pretty much everyone uses ggplot. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, Python is a bit of more general purpose, broad language, and the kinds of convenience and simplicity that people want varies from group to group or from, you know, area or domain to domain. And so the reason that there are sort of a proliferation of viz tools in Python, which is either a good or bad thing, depending on who you ask, is because they all sort of cater to different, you know, cater in different ways to different use cases and to different, you know, conveniences for particular domains and that sort of thing.
I mean, again, for good or bad, like there's the power of a Python, which makes it easy to kind of build your own tools, or for people to build your own tools specific to your, you know, your unique use cases. But again, that sort of leads to a proliferation of things. So it is kind of a balancing act. I suppose at that point, it's sort of discoverability, right? Like if you can find the good stuff that is relevant to you versus wading through all the stuff that's not.
Do either of you have any tips for wading through the good stuff? I imagine that you've had to do quite a bit of that over the past few years.
Yeah, that's a good question. After a while, you kind of get a sixth sense, I suppose. At least I've noticed. I mean, you get this spidey sense of like, oh, this is abandoned, you know, somehow by just like looking at the commits and like who's working on it and, you know, stuff like that. A lot of it just comes down to following specific people like on Twitter or it's like YouTube accounts. And that seems to be a good source because then, you know, you can interact with them directly. Like just the other day, I saw somebody call out like, you know, what's the latest way of using React, right? And to if I could just Google that, I would get like 10 million results and of varying quality, but very quickly, just by asking a general community, you get a good sense of what was happening in that sphere. So yeah, I keep bringing it up, but community is a powerful hive mind thing to help make you more efficient. It's a good place to reach out for and, you know, foster relationships there.
What would you all be doing if you weren't working on data visualization?
Brian, you can start.
That's a really broad question. Wow, I don't know. Maybe I'd like, you mean if I wasn't doing software at all or?
Yeah, I mean, like what, you know, they say that the 10 to the 23 light years away from Earth, because of the law of large numbers, there's, you know, alternate Earths. And there's another you that took the path untraveled.
The best of all possible worlds. I don't know. I guess, you know, I've always thought it'd be nice to run. Also, you know, before pandemic times, I used to love to go work in coffee shops. You know, I sort of a favorite thing. And I also like to cook and, you know, I like interacting with folks. And so maybe I'd start a nice cozy coffee shop and try to make it a life at that. But, you know, now that we have pandemic times, I'm not quite sure if that's going to work out anytime soon, but, or a bookstore, maybe a bookstore.
That's a good one. That's some nice cats. Well, actually in your case, Brian, I think you'd have like a bookstore snake.
Yeah.
which I would actually love. So what would I be doing? I mean, for a while and still am, frankly, but like big into sustainability and that whole thing, but it's an interesting place to get working because it's like, yeah, it's a tough nut to crack that one. I don't know. I'd like to think I'd be a wind farmer. Yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah, it's easy on the back as farming goes.
Yeah.
Is there anything that I should have asked but didn't?
You know, if it doesn't come across, like we're pretty genuinely believe in Rapids and the stuff that it's doing. And we love the fact that it's open source because it enables us to do all these neat projects related to that. So yeah, I just want to say that's pretty neat for a company to be doing. And the fact that I get to work with all these fantastic individuals like Brian and building up some pretty neat tools for the community.
Yeah, I think I mentioned at the first Rapids group meeting after I started and you know, Josh asked me how I was doing. I was like, this is great. I feel like, you know, a kid in a candy store. There's just so many awesome, interesting, fantastic things going on in whatever direction I look at that it's just great to be in and around that.
Alan, Brian, I want to thank you again for your time. It's been wonderful talking with you today. For our listeners, I'm going to link a bunch of stuff in the episode description. So check that out. Hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.
Yeah. Thanks again. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Join us next week when we have Rapids Fire's first celebrity guest. I'm not going to say who it is, but suffice it to say, I would not be here without the extensive amount of work that he's done to make Python data science a real thing. So I hope you join me for that, and I'll see you next week. Thanks.